Dr. Lawrence Lazarus is the co-author of Insider's Guide to Quality Affordable Healthcare. He addressed questions from audience members at the Opsit Bookstore in Taos, New Mexico on January 26, 2019.
What do I think of a doctor that doesn't take Medicare? Well, I'd have to hear the story of his practice or her practice.
There was a dermatologist, and I went to see him. He said, well, I'll treat this, you know, but that's it. You know, it's Medicare, you know, and I'm not doing Medicare. You know, I don't get enough money from Medicare, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I felt like, well, I was a senior, so I had to do all of this stuff to get here, you know, and pay everything. So it was sort of offensive that he didn't want to treat me for Medicare.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean? And I get your point where, you know, these guys have this and that and the other thing, but I don't see a lot of poor doctors running around either. I mean, you know, some of them make a couple of million dollars a year or more.
Yeah, super specialists might, people who are doing surgery for 6 or 8 hours, orthopedists, neurosurgeons that are doing brain surgery. The doctors that make the least are pediatricians, primary care doctors, internal medicine. And that's why a lot of doctors go into these super specialties. Orthopedic surgeons make a very good living. If I were able to afford it and my doctor wasn't taking Medicare and I had a good relationship and trusted that doctor for years, I would ask, well, you don't take Medicare anymore. What if I became your private patient? What would it cost? Okay. And would my if you ordered tests at a laboratory, would those tests be covered by my insurance? Or if I had, if I had to be hospitalized, can make sure that I'm in a hospital that takes my insurance? You've got to be very proactive. I mean, you see, what's happened to medicine is that it's become big business. Insurance companies, mega medical centers, super specialists, money becomes a much bigger factor than when we were growing up and you'd see your family doctor. And some doctors, I'm sure, in small communities would be paid with a couple of chickens, a pie at the end of the year. Now, I'll tell you what I did with my internist. I had a terrific internal medicine physician in Santa Fe for about 15 years. Okay, I was so appreciative because he took my Medicare. So every Christmas, I knew he liked Italian wine. So every Christmas, I'd pick out 6 bottles of Italian wine because I knew he wasn't making really a good living seeing me, a Medicare patient. Or I'd send him a Christmas card. In other words, you want to do something special. If you have a special doctor that you like, it's good to, doctors feel that they're overworked, underpaid, and there's so much pressure on them now that they have to fill out many more forms than they had to before. Most doctors spend about 10 or 20% of their time doing administrative work, not talking to you for 45 minutes like they used to when we were growing up. And they're a very frustrated group of people, and some of them are not happy. So if you can express your appreciation, you know, I really appreciated when you sent my records right away to the specialist who referred to me. You're actually treating your doctor and trying to make him or her feel good, which shouldn't be your responsibility. But it fosters a good relationship if, in fact, you do appreciate the doctors that go out of their way.
Yes. So I think you are getting to this point. If you see a physician who doesn't take Medicare, can your secondary insurance take over?
No, unfortunately not. In most cases, it can't, because if Medicare is your primary insurance, before the secondary insurance will pay, it has to go through Medicare. Okay, if Medicare rejects it, In some cases, a small number of cases, depending on who you have your insurance with, if it was with the U.S. government and you were in the State Department, or you worked at the lab up in Los Alamos. I have some patients that do. Some of them will pay that secondary insurance. I have a patient with Medicare, and then she turned 65, and she got on some terrific policy from a government job that she had. And for 3 or 4 months, Medicare, we had to send forms and more forms to Medicare to get it rejected. And it took us 3 or 4 months to billing her secondary insurance, and they've started paying after 3 or 4 or 5 months. So there are some, but you need to find that out. You can call your secondary insurance and just ask them, are you going to pay because my doctor doesn't take Medicare and it's going to be rejected? In other words, if your doctor doesn't have a contract with Medicare, Medicare will not pay him. Your doctor has done what they call opt out. He fills out a form. It used to be every year you had to opt out of Medicare.
Every time our Congress reduces the so-called Medicare reimbursement rate, they are solving a budget problem in Washington at the expense of our doctors, and they're increasing the probability that more and more physicians will not accept Medicare. Okay. So the solution to this problem isn't necessarily in the doctor-patient relationship, it's in the patient-congressman relationship. And consider working hard on that one.
Good luck.
That's why it's good to pay. It's good to pay your $25 a year dues to AARP, because as we've gotten older and the geriatric population has gotten bigger and bigger, they have a bigger voice in Washington.
Just to give an example, that in practice right now, if what you have is Medicare patients, you actually won't walk home with a paycheck. You'll have to take out of your retirement savings to pay the office staff and the overhead.
If you had a strictly Medicare practice, that's why doctors have tried to reduce their Medicare population of patients and increase their other private insurance patients. Yeah, I think I mentioned primary care physicians couldn't really work if they were dependent entirely on Centennial Care, which pays much less than Medicare. Medicare, which pays, you know, a reasonable amount, but not as good as the private insurance like Blue Cross. Now, people who work in Congress, they're able to vote and give themselves salary raises. And they also vote to make sure that they all have the best insurance possible. They have better insurance than we can purchase, unless you're working at the lab or you're working in a government job. You know, if you work for the federal government, you get very good health insurance. So, I mean, all people aren't treated equal in the healthcare system, and it's unfortunate. And healthcare has become people are always looking more at the bottom line these days. Doctors are not happy. They were trained, and they used to go into the profession not to become very, very wealthy, because they got gratification out of helping people. And if you get a doctor that you feel really has that as his or her primary interest, you're blessed. And you need to nurture that relationship and tell them, you're too young to retire, even though you're 66. Don't tell me you're going to retire or whatever. You want to keep that doctor. It's not easy to switch doctors. Your records have to be transferred. The doctor has to get familiar with you. It's a big change. It's like moving from here to Indochina when you have to change doctors.
If you go in the hospital today, and I went in with pneumonia here some years ago, before 04, I saw a different hospitalist every day. The hospitalist each asked me the same questions instead of looking at the chart.
Right.
I had to go from the very beginning. Each one of them changed my medication. I feel like with hospitalists, It's great for the doctors. They have regular hours. They're on a salary. And maybe my primary care physician, with all they have to do today, doesn't have time to make rounds anymore. But I feel like there's no continuity. And being in the hospital with hospitalists has really brought down the care.
These days, in any medium size or larger city, your doctor's not going to be the doctor that comes to see you. You're going to be assigned to a hospitalist who doesn't know you. You don't know them. Trust has to develop between a doctor and a patient. It's a very difficult transition period. So there are a few things you can do to make the transition easier and smoother. And one of those things is to bring your medical records with you to the hospital and hope that the hospitalist is curious enough about you that they're going to read your medical records. But even more effective is for you to have a good, your own personal record of what health problems you've had, what medications you're on, and bring that with you. Then another thing is to encourage the hospitalist, let's say it's your first day in the hospital, please call my physician of 25 years. I think you'll get a lot more information.
Will they really take the time to do that when they're seeing so many patients in so many hours?
Well, and then if you have a new hospitalist after 8-hour shift, then you've got to go through the whole thing again. The problem with that, you're hoping that hospitalist A, who's going off shift, has told hospitalist B all about you, and it should be on the computer screen. The new doctor comes in, like a change of shift. If nursing staff has a change of shift, they have a meeting. They talk about every patient, what's going on, what the new nurse needs to know, and in better hospitals, hospitalists are supposed to do that also. Not just going on the screen, but they need to talk to the hospitalist who's leaving. Let's say you're in the military and there's a change of guard. Does the new guard come and hope that they're going to figure out what they're supposed to do? Well, they should tell the guard leaving should tell the new guard, well, there's been some fire explosions, bombs going off over there. You've got to be mindful of that. Transitions, now, so what it comes down to, you try to be the transition person. You try to, a new doctor comes in, starts asking you questions. You can participate in that and have your list of things you want that doctor to know. The healthcare system has a lot of inconsistencies in it, and it doesn't have the kind of coordination that it needs at these transition periods. You have to be the communicator or have a family member who really can spend time with you, or have what they call a patient advocate. A patient advocate is not the same as a power of attorney for medical decisions, who only makes medical decisions for you if you become incapable of doing it yourself. But you can have a family member be your advocate. And if you feel you need somebody, a second set of eyes and ears, you can have that family member or one or more family members go with you to your doctor's appointments, sit in with you, taking notes of what the doctor's saying, and help you in these transition periods. Now, if you don't have a family advocate, and you realize you're starting to get a bit old and your memory is not quite as good and you're forgetting taking medications at certain times, it's a good idea to look into hiring a patient advocate. There are professional patient advocates. Some of them are retired doctors that know the healthcare system pretty well, and they don't charge outlandish fees and can help you. Let's say you have a relative living in a distant city and they're isolated and you're worried about them. You might want to get them a patient advocate so you don't have to lose sleep at night knowing that they're being taken care of. Patient advocacy is a big thing now, and has become bigger because the healthcare system is not coordinated. An advocate can bridge that, know what your health problems are, know where your papers are for your, you know, what you don't want to do is fill out all the paperwork for your HIPAA and living will and put it in the safety deposit box where nobody knows where it is. You've got to make copies of it, make sure everybody has a copy, and then every year or two, when your situation changes, you need to revise those forms, tear up the old forms, and make sure everybody gets a new copy.
How do you find a patient advocate?
In Taos, I would Google patient advocate dash Taos, New Mexico.
They'd be, and they'd be online, they'd be registered.
Or maybe even your doctor would know.
Yeah, the new doctor, if you go into a hospital, for example, and you want some help, you know, understanding how the hospital works, you can ask for a patient representative, okay? But they're hired by the hospital, they're paid. So they might have conflict of interest. If you have some complaints to make, if you have a patient advocate, they might be more neutral and more helpful than hiring a hospital-paid representative. They call them representatives.
Are these patient advocates part of an organization that has standards and that you can check out online?
There are professional organizations. There's a woman who has been writing about patient advocacy and has written books about it. My colleague and I should mention this, we're publishing a book at the beginning of March. But there's a publishing company that's going to publish a book. It's not the size, I don't want to compare it to, but it's more than 250 pages. And in the book, we talk about patient advocacy, how to find a patient advocate, how to interview what you're looking for in a patient advocate. You might interview two or three patient advocates. This is going to be like your buddy going forward.
You'd have to do that when you were well, wouldn't you? If you suddenly got this terrible illness, are you going to be in a position to start interviewing?
Well, if you don't have a good friend or relative living near you, they're in other cities around the United States, you want to hire somebody who you're going to feel a little family feeling toward. They really like you. You like them, and you need to know how long they've been doing this. What are some of the patients they've had, and what are some... You have to enter, just like you're going to hire a lawyer or a doctor, you want to know something about them. Now, doctors might take offense if you're interviewing them for 15 minutes about what medical school and training they've had, but you can look all these things up online. And so you need to be careful who you want to hire as a patient advocate. You may never need them, but it's reassuring.
Oh, I see. So you are talking about doing that in advance of needing them.
Yes. To look into that, I'll tell you a story about my friend. Yes. Come.
I just wanted to ask you and this has to do with what we're talking about, the community health worker. What's their role in this?
When you say community health workers, is this somebody sort of connected to... a community health center,
right,
that goes out and does home visits?
They can, or they can do it in the office as well.
Is that called home care? Is that the organization that you're thinking of home care?
Well, just in general, because I know that's opening up quite a bit and taking the load off, you know, the doctors and upper.
Yeah, well, that person could perform some of the functions of a patient advocate. If you want somebody to accompany you to an important doctor visit and you know that doctor talks fast and uses medicalese instead of, you may want that caseworker, and they do that. It depends on what they're required to do and to what extent. But a caseworker, a really good caseworker who's concerned about you, can do some of those functions. I'll tell you, I have a friend, he's a neighbor, he's older than me. He used an agency in Santa Fe because all of his children lived out of town, and he was beginning to think he was in his mid to late 70s. Well, what if something happens to me? Who's going to notify my children? And et cetera, et cetera. Well, he paid about $150 to hire this agency, and the owner of the agency was about 50 years old, very smart, knew all the resources, and got all the information about him, my friend. If something were to happen to my friend, there was a way of communicating instantly with this office. They would notify the family. The office knew what hospital he would want to go to, had all this information, you know, 3 or 4 pages. And he felt very rest assured. And then he bought a medical alert button that he wore on his belt if something were to happen to him. I guess these are preventative things. You know, if you anticipate some problem, well, why not feel more secure by having a patient advocate?
In Santa Fe, there are boutique doctors that you pay so much a year, and then you can go in anytime you want. I don't know what they do when the person goes out of town, but there are 2 doctors thinking of coming to Taos and charging a yearly fee, and they call themselves boutique doctors. Well, you're looking for a new doctor. How do you feel about, are you going to interview any of those kinds of doctors?
Well, the doctor that I have an appointment with is an internist, and I know another doctor in this 3-doctor practice. And the doctor that I know, because we've had mutual patients, I asked him, how is this doctor, call him Dr. Jones, do you think he and I would be compatible with one another? So I checked that out with this doctor that I know, and he told me he's extremely good and conscientious, and he likes to coordinate whatever care you need. Now, one of the requirements of a good primary care doctor is that they take responsibility for being the captain of your healthcare team. That's what you want. He doesn't have to be an Albert Einstein. He doesn't have to graduate from Harvard. Before the women's liberation. You know, there are more women coming out of medical school today than men. When I went to medical school, it was a class of 100, and there were 7 women in the graduating class. Anyway, I don't know why I went off on that, but I checked him out. Now, I'm going to see him, and I'm going to get a sense of, No, he's not. He takes Medicare and my secondary insurance.
But how do you feel about the boutique doctors? Like, are you going to interview any of them?
I might, if I'm not satisfied with this particular doctor. Now, before we think of disbanding, I want to mention that another doctor who lives in Denver and I have spent 3 years. We just finished a book on... it's entitled The Insider's Guide, because it's written by 2 elderly doctors who want to share our inside stories about insurance, how to find a patient advocate, how to avoid going bankrupt because of medical bills, which the number one cause of bankruptcy in America today, personal bankruptcy, is medical bills. The number one cause, even after the Affordable Care Act. It still is the number one cause. Anyway, so this book has a lot of stuff in it that's not generally known by the lay public. And it's not coming out till March 1st. The other thing I want to mention is this doctor friend of mine, Dr. Foster. He's my age, so we're very compatible with one another. We share war stories. We have a website that we've had now for 1.5 years. It's a monthly website that talks about breaking healthcare news. What's new, what's balanced billing all about? What's this law that was passed about hospitals having to post their list prices? The site is called QualityAffordableHealthcare.net. QualityAffordableHealthcare.net. Okay.
Okay, well, I just wondered, I mean, you can probably talk for hours about this, but the Affordable Care Act right now, where's this going? I mean, a lot of people see that, you know, along political lines, it could be single payer, and just want to get your opinion on that.
I think the Affordable Care Act was a wonderful thing to happen because it reduced very substantially the number of people without insurance. It made it easier in some states, and New Mexico was one of the states that our past governor expanded Medicaid in the state of New Mexico. Very important thing, okay, because the number of people uninsured since the Affordable Care Act has shrunk considerably. Now, that's up until about 2 years ago when Trump came into office and he made it more difficult for people to get insurance. He reduced the number of helpers that were hired at clinics to help people get insurance through the Affordable Care Act. So, but it's still very alive and well. And I think I think what will happen is they're going to try to make it better. And I don't want to get into take sides politically, but the Democrats have been more advocates for more Americans getting health care insurance. And I think with a Democratic House of Representatives, they're going to try to do some things to make the Affordable Care Act better than it is today. So if you have children, by the way, if you have children that are middle-aged or whatever, my advice is to make sure they have health insurance. And if they say they don't feel they need it, ask them if they insure their car. Well, it's a requirement. You have to have car insurance. Now, what Trump has done, too, is he did away with the requirement that everybody has to have health insurance or pay a penalty on their income tax. That, since the beginning of 2019, is not required. So what's happened is a lot of young, healthy people have dropped their health insurance, as predicted. Now, Trump has come out, the Trump administration has come out with short-term insurance policies that are much cheaper than Affordable Care Act policies. And they have a large deductible, and they don't cover all the essential medical treatments that the Affordable Care Act made sure were going to be covered. They don't cover drug abuse treatment, mental health treatment, and the deductibles are very high. But it's better to have some insurance than no insurance at all.
You have been listening to Dr. Lawrence Lazarus, co-author of Insider's Guide to Quality Affordable Healthcare. He spoke and answered questions at Opposite Bookstore in Taos, New Mexico on January 26, 2019. I'm Mike Tilley. This is KCI 90.1 FM.